This show is brought to you by SeatGeek, the perfect place to buy and sell tickets. Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. We have a great episode for you today. Live from the Bay Area, Adrian Wojnarowski and I break down what we've seen through the first two games of the NBA Finals, and we'll get a little bit into Kevin Durant's future in Oklahoma City. Also, Terry Stotts, one of the best coaches in basketball, fresh off a new contract extension with the Portland Trail Blazers, he'll join the podcast as well. That's next, the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Welcome in another episode, Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. We are coming to you live from San Francisco, Union Square, San Francisco, about a half an hour across the bay, where we were just at Golden State's just destruction of Cleveland in Game 2 of the NBA Finals. I'm here with Adrian Wojnarowski, the NBA editor over at The Vertical. And Woj, I would have guessed Golden State wins both. I would not have guessed Golden State wins both so emphatically, especially coming off the series they just played.
Well, Chris, this was a season in which you thought Cleveland and the way they had played in the playoffs, that they had closed the gap on Golden State, that they had found a way for Irving and LeBron James and Love to play together. Their bench was better. J.R. Smith had played well this year, and everything that they've done well has gone out the window so far in this series. They have not imposed anything yet on Golden State, and Golden State played so-so in the first game, won easily, played much better in game two, and absolutely drilled the Cavs. I mean, we thought maybe this would be, you know, had a chance to maybe be something of a classic finals, and right now Cleveland is, they've gotten their doors blown in here.
We knew going in that the Western Conference sort of Final Four, and certainly the Western Conference Finals, was night and day from what the Eastern Conference playoff bracket was. But it's astonishing all the things that defined Cleveland in the Eastern Conference playoffs: the ball movement, the goodwill, Kevin Love, the way he was playing. It's all gone because they're going up against an opponent that is so much better than anybody they came close to facing in the Eastern Conference playoffs. I mean, it's not a knock on Toronto. Toronto's an up-and-coming team, but you know, Golden State is next level, is not doing it justice. It's three levels above what Cleveland's played
at
this point.
Chris, Toronto, they had a guard. When they went to Toronto and lost games 3 and 4, Cleveland had to guard two players. They couldn't do it. DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry, who went off against them. Against Golden State, you've got to guard, at any given time, five offensive players on the floor. Guys off the bench, Andre Iguodala, who's played tremendously well in this series, picked up right where he left off last year as a Finals MVP. And, you know, in Game 2, you saw Cleveland just dare Draymond Green to beat them, and he did. And so you have to defend so many more players on the court in this series. They haven't been able to do it. They tried to run with Golden State,
yeah,
which was an unbelievable mistake. What Cleveland's got to do in this series, and what they're going to have to do in games 3, 4, is to muck it up, to get it in the half court, to get LeBron to the free throw line, get Irving to the free throw line. They've got to find a way to muck this series up, because in the open court, they can't compete with, no one's been able to compete with Golden State in that way, and they certainly can't.
Are they capable of mucking enough up to the point of making this competitive? It just seems, and I like the job Ty Lue did with this team this year. I thought he was more than credible taking over for David Blatt, but I don't see tremendous adjustments being made. In fact, I think everything, and part of it's how great Golden State is, they can counter pretty much everything that you throw at them, but everything, you know, Ty tries out there is just not working for this team. I mean, playing fast, as you said, that was not a good idea. I mean, they seem to be just in total disarray by Golden State switching, which Golden State did all throughout the Oklahoma City series. I don't have great faith that when this series goes back to Cleveland, a change in strategy is going to have any impact whatsoever.
Listen, Cleveland's role players, typically role players play better
right
at home. The J.R. Smiths, Channing Frye, who has been tremendous for them in the postseason, has not made shots in this series. J.R. Smith, those guys tend to, when they're at home, make shots that the great ones, it should be able to travel with LeBron, with Kyrie, and although it hasn't with Kyrie yet in this series.
Yeah, what's happening to Kyrie? I mean, I agree with you. Dellavedova plays better. J.R. Smith plays better when he goes home. These role players will be, you know, maybe what Golden State's role players have been up until this point, with Livingston and Barbosa and others just contributing. You get that from them. But when you're Kyrie Irving, you expect, you're a max player, you're an all-star, you're looked at by most as one of the best point guards in the league. You've got to be better. Why is Kyrie Irving not better at this point?
I mean, really on both ends of the floor, he's not provided any ball pressure on Golden State's guards when he's been in the game. Even in the conference final against Kyle Lowry, Kyle Lowry had some tremendous games, especially late in that series against Kyrie, and the ball hasn't moved. Cleveland has not moved the ball in this series. And I talked to Ty Lue about this after his press conference in game two, and, you know, they've been sloppy with their passes. They're not against this Golden State team. You've got to be exacting in the way the ball moves. They are long. They get in passing lanes. They're quick. They have defenders with great anticipation. And you've seen Cleveland just not take care of the ball. And when you turn the ball over against Golden State, you know, it's either someone shooting an open three at the other end or someone's doing a chin-up on the rim. And so they convert and they make you pay. And they've done that in both games.
Does this tell you anything about, you know, Cleveland's got stars and they're great, but Golden State was just in a knockdown, drag-out fight with Oklahoma City where they had to come back from 3-1 down. Now they're handling, you know, Cleveland the way they are. I mean, I think coming into the postseason, I and a lot of other people thought that, all right, the East is terrible, it sucks, whatever, but Cleveland is still a gold standard that would be competitive with any team in the Western Conference all year long. I know we're only 2 games in and things can change when a team goes home, but I think there's a bigger gap between Golden State and Cleveland than there is Golden State and Oklahoma City.
There's no question. I think Golden State, Oklahoma City, San Antonio, a healthy Clipper team even, would Cleveland beat any of those teams right now? And that's they're in a spot right now where if they get beaten in this series and 4 games or 5. I still would be shocked if they were swept. It's hard to sweep a team in the NBA playoffs, especially a team with LeBron James. LeBron James going home, those are 2 hard games to win. But do they have to look structurally in Cleveland? Their goal is to win a title. It's not to keep winning the East. It's not to be the Buffalo Bills of the next 4 or 5 years here, a team that just can't, you know, who's not good enough to get over the hump. And it isn't just they can't sit around and just wait Golden State out, that whether it's a San Antonio team that reboots or mention Oklahoma City, if assuming Durant stays. It'll be interesting to see what Cleveland does, especially if they get drilled in this series. You wrote about it after Game 2, and, you know, Kevin Love's future. And I think we've always felt the order in which people would be run out of Cleveland. We got number one right. It was David Blatt, and that Kevin Love would be second on that list. That as they didn't win and there were scapegoats, like that's how it would go. And you wonder now, we'll see if Kevin Love comes back in the series with the concussion, but it's hard for them to keep him on the floor in fourth quarters and close games against Golden State over the past season during this year. You know, his inability to defend in that pick and roll, his inability to, you know, defend that athleticism, quickness on Golden State. You know, do they look at creating some more financial flexibility for themselves? Maybe creating, you know, what's the market for him out there? And I still think the market for him would be significant. There's teams who would still love to take his 24, 25, and 12 or 13, what comparable he had in Minnesota, and plug him into a team that's not in the playoffs right now and think Kevin Love can help you get in to the postseason. And there's teams with assets out west, Phoenix, potentially, who's always had an interest in him, that I think if they decide to put him on the market, there'll be a great deal of interest in him.
You know what's bothered me about Kevin Love in this series is that we expected defensively for him to have problems. He just has problems. He's limited on that end of the floor. But offensively is where you would expect him to come through. Eastern Conference playoffs, he made 7 3-pointers in the last 2 games against Toronto. A big reason that Cleveland is here right now and bounced back from those 2 losses that they had in Toronto. Offensively, this series, you know, he was okay in game one. He was brutal in game two before he went out with the head injury. You need to see more from him offensively. When Golden State switches on him and he winds up staring down a Sean Livingston or a Klay Thompson, that's when, if you're Kevin Love and you're the $20 million man, you've got to pound them in the post. Like, you have got to, you wanted to be a post player. All of a sudden, Golden State's switching a 2-guard and a stringy point guard onto you. You've got to take it to them. And I'm not seeing that. I'm not seeing any confidence emanating from Kevin that he can score in those types of situations.
It gets back to it with this, with Kevin Love, with this Cleveland core, about when they're faced with adversity, when things aren't going well. They're a great front-running team. And when things aren't going well and they've got to fight to either get back into a series, to play from behind, it has not been a group with tremendous poise. And that's going to be the question. Love, Kyrie Irving here going home. If Love plays, there's no guarantee with a concussion protocol. It's hard to be back. Typically, it's a 2 or 3 game span. At least it's going to be more than one day. Typically, once you get into the protocol. So having the 72 hours between games 2 and 3 certainly is helpful. But listen, they may go, you know, it may allow them now to, whether it's Channing Frye, they've got to get Tristan Thompson going inside. They need his offensive rebounding, his energy. But they're in a situation now with him where I think they look, again, if they get blown out of this series, do they start to take a, you know, hard look again at what his future is going
to
be there?
I feel like in this series, too, if Kevin's down, you might have to try Mozgov at some point, just because Andrew Bogut and Festus Ezeli are eating – they're eating Cleveland alive on the inside. And Tristan's had some spurts where he's been okay. He's a terrific offensive rebounder. But if you're – you know, Bogut was such a shot-blocking factor in that first quarter when Golden State really wasn't – they weren't in the game as they should have been in that first quarter. Ezeli's been pretty good. Like, if you're not able to contain those 7-footers, you might want to try Mozgov before the end, the start of the fourth quarter, before garbage time, just to throw a different wrinkle at him, because everything they're throwing at him right now just isn't working.
You know, it's amazing. You think back to this time last year and what an integral part Mozgov was for that team. And I mean, he was a player people were talking about might get a max deal, that he might end up a $15 to $18 million a year guy. And obviously he's completely fell out of the rotation here. Really, once Ty Lue took over for David Blatt, I still think he's going to command on the market. I still think he's going to be a $10 million a year player. There's teams with needs at center, and it's not going to be in Cleveland. But, you know, there's certainly teams around the league who – and he's shown an ability to be able to – you know, on both ends of the floor. He's a skilled offensive player. He was that in Denver, and he certainly showed that last year. He just didn't fit in how they were going to play this year. But
is it panicky to use him in this situation? Is it too much of an overreaction to use a guy that has been basically a non-factor throughout this entire playoffs?
It is. I mean, if you're Cleveland and you're sending the message to your group that what has worked for us in the playoffs, what got us here, all of a sudden isn't good enough, that we have to make wholesale changes in what we do and who we are, that's hard to win in the postseason when you do that. Listen, I think there's a belief, well, there's a hope around Cleveland that just getting home, cleaning up some of the turnovers, and then getting Dellavedova, Channing Frye, J.R. Smith, you know, get LeBron to the free, you know, he's going to get to the free throw line more at home, that they can just find a way to settle themselves, get that game 3 win and feel like they're back, you know, that they can get back in the series. But they've lost 7 straight games now over a couple years to Golden State. They've been down more than 30 points twice this year in games to them. And it's got to be creeping into their minds about whether they can compete with them or not.
Yeah, all right. I want to ask you about LeBron in just a second, but I got to tell my listeners here quickly about Jack Irwin shoes. I'm wearing them right now. I was wearing them all around San Francisco this week. I love them. I'm going to keep them. I'm glad I've got them. These are some of the best-looking and well-constructed shoes on the market, handcrafted in Spain and Portugal. The average price is $195, and they do that by bypassing retail markups and selling direct to consumer. Other shoes of the same quality cost 2 to 3 times more. Jack Irwin's are modern takes on a classic design, reliable, built to last, and they're comfortable shoes that conform to your foot over time. Styles range from lace-ups and boots to loafers, casual to dress. New casual offerings include drives and boat shoes available in various colors. Look good. Get yourself some new shoes. Go to www.jackirwin right now to receive free expedited shipping on your purchase by using my code Chris. That's www.jackirwin.com. Select the expedited shipping option on the site and enter the code Chris to receive your offer. Again, go to the site and select expedited shipping, then enter the code Chris. That's jackirwin.com. Enter code Chris at checkout to get free shipping on your order.
They are handsome shoes, Chris.
They're very handsome shoes, and they're comfortable. Can wear them all around this fine walking city. All right, LeBron James, it all comes back to him some way. I mean, this was the team that he put together. You know, David Griffin's the GM, Dan Gilbert's the owner, but this guy has exerted his influence on this organization over the last couple of years, and these are his guys. You know, it's with some, you know, other people mixed in, but this is his team. How much is that, you know, this is now year two, and year one, you give LeBron a pass, all the injuries, but this is year two. All these guys are together. These are his guys. I mean, is how much criticism, if this goes badly, like four or five games, how much criticism does LeBron get? How much criticism do the Cavs get for the team they put together?
Well, he's got to get criticism. If he's going to get credit for the way they rolled through the playoffs, for how well he's played, you're going to get criticism when you come in the finals. He's played okay so far. He hasn't played great. Certainly last year in the finals, he played as well as anyone's ever played in the NBA finals, yeah, and got them to a game six. You know, he'll be judged. You know, they have obviously they go home now. He's going to have to play at not a superstar level, but a historically great level for them to have a chance to come back in this series, because you know, he can still impact the game in so many ways. And he's been active defensively. You know, you've seen him before the game got away from them, the 22 Golden State run and the long runs. He was active. He was in passing lanes. He was a physical presence in the game. He can impact the game in ways, more ways than any player in the league. But of course he's going to be judged on this. These are the pieces he wanted. He helped Tristan Thompson get, you know, an $80 million contract. It limits them. You know, they share the same agent. They're sort of in that together. J.R. Smith's now with him. J.R. Smith will get paid this offseason. And I'm sure J.R. probably, you know, may get paid before LeBron signs his contract. So he's certainly benefiting financially from the group around him. And, you know, they won a lot of regular season games. But he wanted Ty Lue as coach. He's got Ty Lue as coach. He wanted Tristan paid. He's paid. JR will get his contract this summer, and this is his team. And so for them, if they get blown out of this series, if they lose this series in four games, five games, even six games and lose, they're teetering on being known, starting to be known as the Buffalo Bills of the NBA. And that'll be two straight final losses. And I know we'll give them a pass on last year with the injuries, but that'll be three finals losses in Cleveland going back to his first trip in 2007. The whole idea was to come back and win one. I think the idea was he'd come back and win multiple titles. Getting that one may be harder than even he thought it might be there.
I tell you what, it should be a little bit nerve-wracking in Cleveland to not get a title this year, if that's the way it shakes out, because I don't know when it's coming, when the body starts to break down for LeBron. He's superhuman in a lot of ways, but he's still a guy that came into this league at 18 years old, who has played a lot of playoff games, who has not had his body break down up until this point. At some point, if you're the Cavaliers, and this is your core, you're going to have to rely on Kyrie Irving and a few others to get better as LeBron regresses. And I'm not sure that's going to happen at the progression for Kyrie Irving that's going to make them true contenders. They're going to be able to win the Eastern Conference. The Buffalo Bills analogy is apt because at least for the next 2 years, I don't see a team, barring some historic offseason by Boston or somebody else, I don't see a team competing with them. At the same time, this group, if Golden State's healthy, if Oklahoma City's healthy, even San Antonio, if they stay healthy, those teams are going to be a cut above the Cavaliers, and that's not going to get better as LeBron gets older.
It's not, and they've got to decide. You know, we'll see how these finals play out, but they've got to decide, do they make dramatic change with this group? Do they make dramatic change with the core, with their big three? And are they good enough? And
you know, doesn't that put you down the path, though, too, of like, okay, you get new players in, but then you got to kind of do the acclimation stuff all over again, and that's
right,
a year-long process.
Right. And that's a decision organization's got to make of, do you keep building with that group and think, we got closer, we're getting closer, even if, you know, even if we get drilled in this series, that we'll have a full training camp with our new coach next year, and we'll... But when you make that kind of wholesale change, it is hard for teams to be able to win right away. And what are the potential deals out there? LeBron's going to have a lot of say in that, because he does. He has a lot of say in personnel there, the decisions they make. And David Griffin's a good GM. He's proven that. You know, they have to decide in terms of style of play, how the league's changed. You know, the compatibility of those three. Listen, when things are going well, Kyrie, LeBron, Kevin Love can put on a face of, you know, that there's a cohesion there with that group. But the minute things start to get sideways, and this is what teams watch, coaches, players in the, especially in the East, who are around them more, the teams in the East can't put that pressure on Cleveland that the teams in the West can. So Toronto, Atlanta, they love to get Cleveland on the ropes. They're not talented enough to do it. But teams believe that, listen, they're a great front-running team, and that the unity of that group is not there. I don't think they love playing with each other. I don't think it's a close group. And you can win without them being close, but it'll be interesting to see what direction LeBron wants to go with this if they can't get back into this series. It is not easy to trade a Kyrie Irving. It's not easy to trade a Kevin Love. Trying to get value, trying to find that balance of what do multiple draft picks get Cleveland? That doesn't help them. You know, a potential deal, let's say a hypothetical deal with Phoenix, they have plenty of picks to offer. And I think if you're Cleveland, either of those players, you'd want to send them out of the conference. But picks don't get you closer to a title with LeBron post 30 years old now. They need players right now, a group that can help them surround him to win. And those will be tough choices for that organization.
Do you put any – I mean, people ask me all the time, like, could LeBron – if they win, does LeBron leave? If they lose, is LeBron leave? I feel like he's tied himself there. I understand that there's always in the water supply, you know, the idea that he could walk, but I can't see it.
I didn't believe that this year. I didn't believe he would. I've changed my thinking based on a lot of what I've heard. Like, if they lose, it's really hard for him to leave.
Yeah.
But if they do win it, he can say, I came back home, I won a title, I gave them what they wanted, I gave them what I promised I would or what I would try to do. And where he'd go from there, I don't think he can do it and be able to keep his... I think he would take a lot of heat for leaving after winning, there's no question. But he can't do it without a title. He can't come back for 2 years, not win, and walk. He can't live that down. Could he win a title and leave? Yeah, he probably could sell that to people on some level and then decide wherever it is he wants to go again. But I was one who thought the 1 year that he did not really hold much. This idea that he was holding tremendous leverage over the organization by having these one-year deals, you felt like if you were Cleveland, you would dare him to leave. You're not going to do that to your image again. You're not going to. But that's based on losing. If they do win one, I guess I can see now a scenario where he would do it. Certainly it's been talked about. I've heard it more talked about from people around his group that it hasn't been ruled out down the line. Now, whether that's this year, next year, until he signs a multi-year deal,
yeah,
it's clear he's not making a commitment to that place.
There would be such a tremendous hypocrisy to it just because – you know, we all go back to that letter and the careful construction of it, and everything he said in it was on purpose. Everything, every word he put in there. And the basketball part of it was one thing, but this whole notion of the need to become this role model.
See, I never believed that was a very important part
really.
Of it. This was, I always believed it was about having control of the organization. He didn't have it in Miami. He didn't have it with Pat Riley, Mickey Arison, Eric Spoelstra.
Which is were his best years, ironically.
Right. And he needed it at that point in his career. And every player needs it. In Cleveland, his ability to make decisions on personnel, who's around, you know, that they have the run. He and his group have the run of that place. And Cleveland had to acquiesce to all that to get him back. And it fills their arena. Whether they win a title or not, it's extremely profitable for them, obviously, to have him back. And so they've acquiesced to all that again. But I always felt it was more of a business decision. It was more of a, he's able to make, there's commissions to be made off of teammates who have deals. Is Tristan Thompson overpaid there? Yes, he's overpaid there. Will J.R. Smith probably get overpaid this summer? Probably will get overpaid this summer. So I never bought in so much to the emotional. Listen, I do think Northeast Ohio is important to LeBron James. I do think that community is important to him. I would never suggest it isn't, but I think the primary reason of leaving Miami was to be able to have organizational control that just did not exist and would never exist for him in Miami. And so while I get the letter, I understand that it meant a lot to people in Ohio to hear that, but to me it was a business decision.
It's the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Not all ingredients out there are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients taste better and are better for you, so it's important to know where your food comes from. I've tried Blue Apron. I love it. I'm not a big cooker, but man, these ingredients, this stuff, it's fantastic. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with the incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the best. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. There's variety with new recipes created every week by Blue Apron's culinary team and not repeated within a year. It's flexible. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Choose delivery options to fit your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you can only get deliveries when you want them. It's very easy to. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Check out this week's menu and get your two meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/Mannix. You will love how good it feels and how it tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/Mannix. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
We got to finish with Golden State because you got to, you know, we'll be giving them credit for a while, no doubt. But this is, you know, the Western Conference remains a gauntlet and you're one injury away, a minor injury away from that being the difference in, you know, winning a championship and losing in the second round. But you know, this is really a special looking team. You know, when I watch them play, all these guys that seem, we just spent 10 minutes talking about Cleveland and how they play together. And there's not a lot of, there may not be a lot of love, you know, amongst teammates there. This group of guys seems like they genuinely enjoy playing with each other and everything kind of fits. You've got the alpha male in Steph Curry. You know, Klay could be the alpha male elsewhere, but he seems pretty happy with what he's doing. Draymond Green got his money and he's, you know, an all-star type every single year now. These guys have 3, 4, maybe 5 years left in them where if health holds up, you know, they could make a run. I mean, I don't know what their ceiling is, but, you know, they've got a championship now. They're 2 wins away from a second. You could be 3, 4 champions with this team very easily, if not beyond.
You know, Oklahoma City had a chance to knock them off in significant part to Curry's injury. He was not himself different points in that series. He played well when they needed him to near the end. Klay Thompson kept them in that series. And that was a Oklahoma City team that had beaten San Antonio. Obviously, gets up 3-1. It is fragile. It's not easy to do this every year. I remember Bob Myers said to me, I kind of thought this year might be easy. We won a title. We've got a hungry group coming back. We've stayed healthy. And then, you know, they win 73 games, and then all of a sudden they get down 3-1, and they find out something about themselves. I don't know if Cleveland could come back 3-1 against anybody, but this is a team that loves playing together. Steph Curry's leadership with this group, you know, it's funny. People have started to talk about the Splash Brothers again in these playoffs. you didn't hear much about the Splash Brothers in the regular season. It was all about Steph. It was all about an historic, unanimous MVP season. And when, from outside the organization, that's how it looked. Within it, Steph Curry never let Clay think that it was ever about anything other than the two of them. It's been about the two of them since they traded Monta Ellis 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And Steph has always made Clay feel a part of it, that it's not, it's us. And when they needed Clay, Clay was there for him. Not every player of Steph's stature would allow Draymond Green to have the voice that he has on that team. Steph knows that Draymond needs that to have a big voice, to have that big booming persona, that it helps Draymond play, that it helps their group, and he allows them. He doesn't. That's what makes Steph a great leader, is that he's allowed all these guys around him to be themselves and has made them all feel like it's still about a team there. And it's been remarkable, the culture they have, and it comes from Steph. It's very similar to what San Antonio had with Tim Duncan and how that group prospered around him, and he allowed everybody around him to reach their potential, to have tremendous, you know, impact on their success, and that it never had to be about him. And with Steph, I think he goes out of his way with that team, with that group, and it makes a difference.
You were at the forefront of the reporting about Kevin Durant and Golden State and the interest the Warriors could have in him this offseason. It's almost insane to suggest a team should not pursue a player both of the skill and the person. Like, Kevin Durant is also a great person, too, and a great competitor, but if you win two championships, how hard is it for a guy like Bob Myers and Joe Lacob, and obviously a guy like Steph Curry would be involved in something like that because he is the franchise player, but that's got to be incredibly hard to, you know, to suggest you bust up the core a little bit, you let Harrison Barnes walk away, maybe you have to move Bogut too to get a player like that, even if it's of Durant's caliber, because this is, you know, it's not a team with a finite shelf life right now. I mean, these guys could be this team for the next 3 years at least.
I still think they would do it.
I don't disagree. Yeah. I just think it's got to be an incredibly hard decision. I mean, yeah, the only team in the league, the only team that would have a hard decision of pursuing Kevin Durant.
And the way they beat Oklahoma City, they made it hard. It would be awfully hard for Kevin Durant now to go to Golden State. It reminds me a little bit of Jason Kidd in New Jersey when he lost in the finals to the Spurs and then had a decision to make about going to the Spurs as a free agent. In the end, just felt like that he would be gravy training on it and just couldn't leave, didn't go. And there were other factors too. But the way this season went for Oklahoma City and the fact that they finally found themselves, beat the Spurs, almost, you know, had that lead, it's going to be hard. But there was a point certainly this year, and back when I reported on the mutual interest, Golden State's been all in on this for, you know, they knew before the playoffs last year they'd be going after Kevin Durant. That's how teams, they plan their free agency out 2-3 years. That's how the league works. No matter whether you're 44-4 or 4-44, you're planning your team and your roster years out. And I do know that they had always felt that Durant could seamlessly fit in because of his, you know, he's not a guy with a big ego.
No. Nope.
And it didn't have to be about him. And I think he likes having Russell Westbrook. He likes having guys who take the burden off of him. And certainly have that in Golden State. And Golden State felt that Durant would be a guy who could take a lot of the scoring burden off of Steph, that they were depending a lot on him. They're moving into a big, expensive downtown arena in San Francisco. They've got to sell suites. They've got to, you know, they've got to pay for that arena. You bring in a Kevin Durant, from your local television ratings to merchandising to all those things that he brings tremendous value to. This is a business, and so I think, again, and he's not a guy who you feel was going to be, who people worry can't fit in. Kevin will always fit in. That being said, I still think the most likely scenario now is he goes back on that 1+1 deal and sort of punts on his free agency. I do think he'll go through the process.
Yep.
I don't think this is going to happen on July 1 or 2nd or 3rd. It could change. I mean, he's sorting it out now with his people, but I still think there'll be some kind of a process, and it could hold up free agency in July, but he can sort of just punt on it this year and then really put a lot of the pressure on Russell Westbrook next year. Kevin would not have to be the bad guy and leave if he left next year. There would be some shared stuff there with Russell based on what Russell's going to do. And if Russell decided to leave, Kevin could say, hey, Russell didn't stay. I'm going to go too. But he would share that pressure, that burden would be shared on both of them. Right now, that pressure is all on Kevin, coming off a year where the team achieved, where you feel like they're closer to a championship. They're closer to Golden State than they certainly felt they probably were at the beginning of the year. You know, there's a lot of reasons for him to want to give it another crack there.
Man, next year would be wild in Oklahoma City if that were the case, just because Durant, Westbrook, Serge Ibaka, even Steven Adams being eligible for a new contract after the year, that would be like the greatest three-day span in July Oklahoma's ever seen, or the worst in a long time there in Oklahoma.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how Kevin approaches this, what's important to him, because all along I've been told around him, and I think you have too, Chris, that I always believe this with free agents. It's you can categorize them in two groups, in my experience. There's players who are looking for reasons to leave, and there are players who are looking for reasons to stay. And I've always believed Kevin has been looking for reasons to stay in Oklahoma City, and that he got them in this season. He found a coach in Billy Donovan who grew rapidly on the job, really impacted winning in the postseason, was tremendous in the playoffs, and you saw the development of some of the younger players, their pieces. And you look at Oklahoma City and that team coming back, you know, they should be a 65, 66 win team, regular season team next year. They should come out of the gates like gangbusters early with this group back, and they have an ability to help their bench even a little more this summer. They have their mid-level exception. So, you know, there's a lot of momentum for Kevin Durant to stay, but it's still his decision in the end.
Let me finish with the Warriors and the one thing I think that could derail them, and besides injury, is money. These owners, you mentioned the building they have and the suites they have to sell and all that, and granted there is an influx of money coming beginning next summer, but you know, these owners in the next 2-3 years are going to pay a lot of money, or have to pay a lot of money, for a lot of contracts that are coming up. If Harrison Barnes sticks around, you know, he might be a close to max player or a max player right now. Steph Curry's contract comes up, and that's a automatic.
They'll probably get the max.
I'm thinking, you know,
he may get a raise off his $11 million a year.
Some negotiation there. He's like the ninth highest paid player in this series right now. Is that, do you think, going to be an issue for this ownership group in Golden State?
I don't. And Bob Myers and I were talking about it on the podcast the other day, and he just said the one thing that he has found with Joe Lacob, if he has told him it's about winning, it's going to help them win whatever it is, and they've been in the tax, they'll be in the tax next year. Lacob isn't willing to spend, and I think once you're achieving at this level, it is hard to – it's harder to cut corners financially when you're winning big. When you're not winning big and you keep putting money into a money pit, there's some owners who start to back off and say, this isn't worth it, I'm not seeing a return on it. But you don't want your legacy to be you shortchanged some decisions here or there to save in the tax, and you cost your team more championships. Joe Lacob's competitive. He certainly has the resources. Their group does. And it is going to be expensive for them. And I think you're going to see a league more than ever, the haves and have-nots. I think where the salaries are going, where the cap's going, there's going to be teams, I don't care how much television revenue is coming in, there are going to be organizations who are going to back off. And I know they're saying, hey, everybody's got to spend this summer, next year, with the cap going up. And you have to spend to get to the floor. But I think you're going to see the committed ownership groups and the ones who aren't very committed, I think that gulf is going to grow even more, and Lacob and his group have been super committed to this, you know, and it's going to cost them money. They've got a GM in Bob Myers that eventually they're going to have to pay, like mm-hmm. one of the top GMs in the league. They're going to have to pay Steve Kerr, like one of the top coaches in the league. And you mentioned Harrison Barnes is going to get a big offer sheet out there. He just is. That's the economics of this. Steph's going to get his max deal next year. So they're going to have to pay for this success.
Whoa, Jitson, honor to be sandwiched between you and JJ and the Vertical Podcast schedule these days. Appreciate you staying up late, man.
Chris, always good to be with you.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
If you've ever been frustrated buying tickets online, SeatGeek is the place for you. Most sites make it complicated, and they all try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They made it easier than ever to buy and sell sports and concert tickets. I've used it. It's fantastic. I recommend it to everybody out there. SeatGeek is the only place I ever go to look for tickets to a game or to a concert. They pull all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you can save time and you never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek would let you know if ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. Best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. Unlike StubHub, they show you the full ticket price range from start to finish and never try to trick you with huge fees on the checkout page. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get that $20 rebate, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code. Enter promo code Mannix, M-A-N-N-I-X. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Download the free SeatGeek app, enter promo code Mannix today. Well, if you had the Portland Trail Blazers winning 44 games, advancing to the Western Conference semifinals, and giving the Golden State Warriors all they could handle in that series, well, I want to become gambling buddies with you. I mean, I can't remember a team as surprising as Portland this season. And I'm not just saying that because in my capacity as Sports Illustrated's preseason prognosticator, I picked the Blazers to finish, dead last in the conference, and I was dead wrong. A big reason for that was the work of Terry Stotts, the Portland Trailblazers head coach, who was recently rewarded with a new contract extension. And Terry joins me here on the podcast. How many times did you remind your guys, Terry, of where they were projected to finish in the preseason?
You know, not once, actually. We had a lot of pride and a lot of confidence coming into the season. Matter of fact, even at the beginning of the year, we all knew where everybody had us picked, and I didn't even have to bring it up because they all knew, and I didn't want to belabor the point. So, you know, usually when you have bulletin board material like that, it can come in handy, but it was so well known that I didn't even need to use it because all of our guys were well aware of it.
I want to get to this season, but I want to ask you, is this your first contract extension as a head coach?
No, actually, after my second year in Portland, mm-hmm. I had signed a 2-year with an option year when I got to Portland. So after we beat Houston in the first round and made it to the second round, I got a 2-year extension there.
Extension like this after the season that you had, and I want to get into some of the things that you've gone through in your coaching career, but how does that make you feel when you kind of, I don't know what it is, but maybe it's a certain level that you've reached as a head coach to be in this position now?
Well, it's very rewarding, especially after, my first two stops. I was in Atlanta for less than 2 years. I was in Milwaukee for less than 2 years. And to be able to come in to a situation like Portland and now get a second extension and to be able to have the success that we've had, and it's rewarding not only as the head coach, but just for the players that have come through here and gotten better. The fan base is terrific. I think there's a trickle down, not only personally, but within the city, within the organization, of what it means to have that done.
Is there another coach in the NBA with a degree in zoology?
I don't know if there's ever been a coach in the NBA with a degree in zoology. I don't even think I'm going out on a limb on that one.
What drives one to go into zoology? I'm just curious.
Well, I was a pre-dental major, and I had planned on going to dental school. And to have a pre-dental major, you have to have a science major. Mm-hmm. So it's chemistry, physics, microbiology, botany, something like that. And I just I went with the animals.
I can. Is it wrong that I can see you as a dentist? I can
you
see root canals.
See me as a dentist? I would have been a very good dentist. My bedside manner would have been very calming and soothing, and I would have given a lot of confidence to my patients until the drilling started.
And then?
And then who knows?
Were you good at your, I mean, I don't know how far you went as pre-dental, but were you any good at that, at the practicing it, if you will?
No, no, I didn't. I was accepted to dental school after my 4 years of undergrad, but I never went to dental school, so I never had a chance to actually get my fingers in any mouths or anything like
that. How close were you to, you know, I know you went overseas to play basketball, but how close were you to saying, you know what, forget basketball, I'm doing this?
Well, it depended on where I got drafted. You know, I got drafted in the second round. If I had gotten drafted in the fourth, fifth round, you know, back then there were 10 rounds. If I had, if I hadn't gotten drafted where I did, or if I hadn't had a nice opportunity to play in Europe, I would have gone to dental school. But, you know, as it turned out, I had a good senior year. I got drafted high enough. I had some offers to go to Europe for good situations like Real Madrid. So I really wasn't that close, but you know, with all intents, in January and February of my senior year, my expectations were to go to dental school.
Isn't it funny how you know, circumstances can shape to such amazing events? I mean, I have this conversation with coaches all the time. I mean, Brad Stevens was like a pharmaceutical rep for a little while before he got into coaching.
You know what? I did not know that, but I went after my playing career in Europe. I finished my master's in business at Oklahoma, and I was interviewing for pharmaceutical rep positions and with Upjohn and Merck and things like that. And I was actually offered a job with one of them, but I got a call from two different teams in Europe the day after I was offered a job with the pharmaceutical rep. And I ended up continuing playing basketball for two more years. But I was within a couple days of being a pharmaceutical rep.
Just think, instead of meeting on the floor, you and Brad Stevens could have been at like the Springfield Suites in Omaha, exchanging.
Well, notes. I'm quite a bit older than Brad, so I don't.
Yeah,
know
but you know, he'd be a young
hopefully,
guy, and you'd be.
I would have progressed a little bit in that time in between.
You had a long career overseas. I mean, those experiences. How rewarding were they for you? And what do you think about when you look back on them?
I really enjoyed living over there. You know, I was playing over there before the big money hit, where in the later 80s when, you know, Danny Ferry and those guys were going over there and making a lot of big money. But I really enjoyed the living experience. I was able to live in Madrid and Paris for a year. I was able to live in smaller towns in Italy and France. So I got the best of both worlds. I enjoyed the language, the people, the food. And like I said, I didn't make a ton of money, but enough to get a little bit of a nest egg. But more than anything else, it was the opportunity to live in Europe.
When you go over there originally, and your first stop, I believe, was what, Italy, right?
Right.
Yeah. Where do you go by yourself? Do you bring family, friends, anyone with you?
No, I went by myself. You know, it was my first year out of college, and it was all new. Back, you know, 1980. Certainly, there were some players going over there and playing, but it wasn't as well known or as prominent as it is today. But it was, you know, it was in a small town called Cantu, which is up by Lake Como, and basketball was very. They were very passionate about the basketball, and it was a small town, and it was a great experience. I had Bruce Flowers from Notre Dame was my teammate, and it was short. I got cut in November, but it was a very, very positive experience for me.
Lake Como's nice.
Oh, it's beautiful. My wife and I went there 4 years ago. It was unbelievable.
You got the house next to Clooney's out there, I assume.
I think they were chasing me away from the property.
you know, when you're playing in the you know, this Italian league, and then Spain, France, and briefly, I believe, what, in Montana as well. I mean, what keeps you going in those circumstances? As you mentioned, you're making, you know, okay money, but it's not like the big money that you see some European players making right now. What keeps you playing, you know, 8-9 years in these foreign leagues?
Well, I think the bottom line was probably just my the joy of playing basketball. I mean, it's a great lifestyle. You grow up playing basketball. It's what you do. It's part of your identity. But just the joy of playing basketball for a living. Certainly, you do make some money, and that's part of it. but it allows you to continue that part of your life. And I think there's so many athletes that go through that where it just stops, whether it's in high school or after college. At some point, it's going to stop. And very few people are ready for it to stop because of the enjoyment they get from playing. And, you know, it's hard to give it up because it's very unique. And anybody who's been involved with sports, you know, even talking to high school players or former teammates of mine, that their best year, they remember the last game of their sectional in high school. I mean, those are very special years, and I think that's what it is for especially basketball players.
The best moment for Terry Stotts, the player, in his days was what?
Probably winning the Big 8 championship my junior year. Mm-hmm. It was the first time Oklahoma had won a conference championship in 31 years, and it was I was part of a special group of players that we overachieved. We weren't necessarily picked to do that well, but we won the championship, and winning that championship and then winning the postseason tournament, conference tournament as well, was no question for me personally as a player. That was the highlight.
And as a pro?
As a pro, it was my second to last year in Rouen, France. Mm-hmm. And again, a team that we were probably, there were 16 teams in the conference, and we were probably picked about 9th or 10th. And we were in second division. We ended up finishing second in the division, which allowed us to move up to first division the following year. So it was, again, a very special group of guys. And, you know, certainly there are games along the way that you remember individually, but for a guy in a team sport, those are the things for me that I remember most is the team success. And that was, we had a nice party that night in France.
Is there a language barrier for you on a team like that?
Well, there wasn't for me. You know, I had some background in school with French and Spanish, so. And when I first went to Italy, I got all the tapes and books and dictionaries, so I studied it. And the fact that Italian, French, and Spanish are all very similar in the way the language is constructed, that I didn't have any difficulty. But, you know, if I were to go to a country like Turkey or China or something that's completely, cliche, completely foreign to me, then you know, I don't know how that would be, but in those countries with the Romance Latin-based language, I didn't have any difficulty.
Yeah, I took Latin, and I got nothing to show for it.
Well, yeah, there's not a lot of use for Latin.
I got nothing. It's like,
other than giving you a good base for learning other languages.
No, you know, people say that. I don't even know if I buy that. I took 8 years of it, Terry. I don't know anything about anything. You know, supposedly it helped my SATs. I don't know if that was really true or not. So.
Well, you know, if you go on a spelling bee or something, at least you'll understand some of the, you know, some of the way some of the words are constructed.
That's great. I'm 36 years old. That was well worth it. I'm glad I did all that.
It's the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Whether you're wearing a suit or sweats, you spend almost 24 hours a day in your underwear. That's true. But instead of making a statement like Superman's tights under his everyday clothes, your underwear is probably boring. MeUndies is here to change all that. Every pair of MeUndies is made from sustainably sourced modal, a fabric that's twice as soft as cotton. Nothing can describe the fit and feel of MeUndies, but once you try them on, you'll understand why they're called the world's most comfortable underwear. That's true. If you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free. No questions asked. MeUndies has dozens of styles and limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. Remember, Superman. Shipping is free in the U.S., and you can save up to $8 with the MeUndies subscription plan. Gotta get the subscription plan. Get the subscription or go a single pair. Get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/Mannix. That's MeUndies.com/Mannix for 20% off your first order. MeUndies.com/Mannix.
So your playing career finishes and you come back, and you mentioned you went back to Oklahoma to get your business degree. Was your mindset, you know, all right, I'm done with basketball, I'm going to move on to the next phase?
I really didn't know. You know, I knew that I was not going to go to dental school, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I thought that an MBA would be a functional degree for me, and it bought me some time to kind of figure out what I was going to do, what opportunities might be there. And that was, I guess I was kind of delaying any decisions, because really at the end I wasn't necessarily qualified to do anything, except I was a good student, so I went back to school. But I didn't know, getting my MBA was just buying me some time to figure out what I wanted to do.
Kept going back to dental school. I kept thinking that dental school.
No, I kind of shied away from that after about 2 or 3 years. I wasn't ready. I kind of went back on that one pretty quickly.
So how did the Albany Patroons kind of come along, George Carl, his staff there?
Well, you know, I played for George in Great Falls, Montana for 3 seasons, mm-hmm. and we became very good friends. We stayed in contact. When I came back every summer, I would go to Cleveland. Matter of fact, I played on one of his summer league teams in Cleveland. I went back to, when he was in Golden State, I went to summer league with him and watched some of his teams and practices there. So we stayed in contact. We were very good friends. So my last year playing in France, I was in Paris, and he was actually coaching in Madrid, Spain. And I knew that was going to be my last year. I called him and said, you know, I really want to be your assistant coach next year, wherever it is. And he said, sure. And the next year happened to be the Albany Patroons. And it turned out to be a great experience for me. Obviously, with being with George and learning from him, we had a fantastic season. And, you know, it really got me off onto a good start in the coaching career.
It had to have been kind of a risk, though, right? When you jump into a team like Albany CBA, I would imagine there's not a lot of money there for an assistant coach. I mean, how big a risk did you consider it at that time?
I really didn't consider it much of a risk. I finished playing, and it was something that I wanted to do. Like I said, staying involved with basketball was very important to me. There were other things that I could have gotten. There were times in over that 10-year period where I could have gotten out of basketball, as I mentioned with the pharmaceuticals. But it was something that I wanted to try. And when I made that call to him in Madrid, I knew that I wanted to do it, and he knew that I was serious about it. So I didn't really consider it a risk. I was actually counting on it.
Did you take to coaching right away? Was it the kind of thing that, you know, you get into it and you're like, wow, this is exactly what I want to do, or was it something different?
You know, it was different in that I didn't know all that was that was different, too. It was 25 years ago. But, you know, I played – there's only a 10-man roster. Back then, the players were, you know, 25, 26, 27, 28 years old. So I wasn't that far removed from a lot of the guys that were in the CBA. It was an older league. So I was able to practice more with the players rather than necessarily teach them. But what I learned more from George at that time was game management, practice plans, just what you want to do as a coach and supervising, and rather than the coaching of player development. That part of it came later, like when I went to Seattle.
Yeah, you had a front row seat for some pretty fun and impressive Seattle teams in the 1990s. I'm almost as curious about the George-Gary Payton relationship. I've had Gary on the podcast before, and he's told some incredible stories about, you know, just the combativeness between the two. There was always this mutual respect, but you know, if the stuff that happened, let's put it this way, if the stuff that happened between Gary and George in the 1990s happened today, I would imagine it would be mushroomed out of control to be viewed as this incredibly dysfunctional relationship.
Well, there's so many things. You could say that about so many different relationships and situations that happened 25 years ago and if they were to happen today. But and, you know, I think you go about your business differently now than you would then. But, you know, George is a fiery guy and very committed and passionate about basketball, and so is Gary. And they did butt heads, but I think they both had mutual respect. But that's what made them both excellent at what they did. And, you know, it's easy to get things caught. You know, I always remember the video clip, I think it was in Houston, where George and Gary are kind of yelling at each other. I don't think that would necessarily happen today, but it's a different time. But certainly I think they were both very good for each other.
I feel like if that happened today, too much would be made of it. It seems like in today's game, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it just seems like in today's game, we have this expectation that players and coaches should almost be robots, that there should be no emotional outburst in the heat of battle. That, and you can make almost the comparison with Westbrook and Durant. Everybody looks at those two guys and looks for every shoulder shrug or eye roll. And the reality is, you know, 80s, 90s, even as recently as 10 years ago, stuff like that, it wasn't uncommon, I guess.
No, things happen. You know, and just to a minor degree, I remember, you know, when Miami was playing in Dallas, I think it was LeBron's first year in Miami, and he grazed Coach Spoelstra going back to the bench during one of the timeouts. And so much was made of that. And that was just, that would be just not even a blip on anybody's radar 20 years ago. You know, I think people are much more savvy about how information is spread with social media and everything. And so everybody's a little bit more careful. But, you know, it's, you got to play with passion. You got to coach with passion. You're not always going to be politically correct in the heat of battle, and I think people understand that.
Your first two head coaching jobs, Atlanta in 02 and then 05 in Milwaukee, when you look back at those first two opportunities for you, would you do things differently now? Were you a different coach back then?
Well, I'm a different coach now than I was then because I've gained a lot of experience both as a head coach and as an assistant coach. You know, I can't say what I would do differently or if I would do anything differently. It's you know, kind of a long time ago, but you just do the best job you can and go with what you think is best at the time. And like I said, I can't think of any specific situations that I would do differently. Obviously, I do think that if I were in either of those situations, I would approach it differently. And I can't say how I would do that other than to say I'd probably approach it the way I approach a job here in Portland. You know, I've my coaching now, I really rely on my staff a lot, use a lot of video with the players more so than then. I'm communicate with the players differently. The advent of text messaging is a great way to communicate with your players and keep involved. There's just so many different ways of that I coach now versus then. And it's just, I think it's just over time you evolve with what you have. And I think the other thing, and I've said this before, is that when I got the Atlanta job and to a large degree the Milwaukee job, is my only real experience was with George Karl for 10 years. And having been in Dallas for 4 years and seeing a different way of doing it, I think helped round me out as a coach a little bit to see a different approach and feel more comfortable in how I wanted to approach my job.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because you did have a very successful run with the Mavericks as an assistant coach, winning a championship there in Dallas. What did you take from that? Like, what did you layer onto your coaching skills that you got there? You know, watching and observing and working under a guy like Rick Carlisle.
Well, the thing about Rick and George Karl is that they're both very successful coaches. They're very passionate about the game, but they go about their job differently. And for me to be able to observe George for 10 years and then Rick for 4 years, that, you know, whether it's how you utilize your staff or how you communicate with your players and how you manage your game, and I thought just the balance of those two, because they were in many ways very opposite of each other in their approach in some things. And I was able to take from Rick and kind of augment that with my background from George and kind of meld it into what I felt would work for me. And, you know, and I think also the way the game and the way the league has changed was also part of it. But I really liked the culture that we had developed in Dallas, and a lot of that had to do with Mark Cuban and Dirk Nowitzki and Donnie Nelson, but also with Rick there as well. It was a different way of going about your business that I think a lot of coaches don't have that opportunity to see different ways if they're always under one coach or one way of doing things.
When you lost the job in Milwaukee, were you eager to get another opportunity? Did you sit back and say, you know, maybe assistant coaching is the way I could go? I mean, what was your mindset after that job?
Well, my mindset was to get back into the league and be an assistant coach. You know, I was very honest with myself, knowing that, you know, I had two opportunities. I was an under .500 coach, and the likely things would have to be pretty special for me to get another opportunity, and things worked out that way for us. But my mindset was to get back in the league as an assistant coach, hopefully with a good head coach and a good situation, and it couldn't have worked out any better for me to be with Rick and to be with the Mavericks, a team that had I don't know how many consecutive 50-win seasons at the time, and being with Rick, who had been coach of the year and had a lot of success in Detroit and Indiana, so I couldn't have asked for a better situation.
Do you have to be... I don't know if humbled is the right word, but it's got to be in some ways humbling to be, you know, a head coach on a couple of different stops and then to go into a situation as a full-time assistant again. Is there any ego you have to keep in check there, or do you seamlessly kind of transition back into that role?
It wasn't difficult for me at all. Even after Atlanta, you know, I was there for a year and a half, and that situation was a little tenuous anyway because mm-hmm. there was ownership issues. And so even though I was the head coach, I felt like I was an interim coach for a year and a half. So I went to Golden State for a season to be an assistant. And so I had no qualms about going back to being an assistant. I had been an assistant for a long time, and I felt like I was a good assistant and I would be an asset to any program that I went to. So that was pretty easy for me.
So if you flash back, Terry, to, you know, about, you know, 13 months ago now, after all the upheaval that you had with the Trailblazers, if you could have projected that you'd be here right now, you know, not, you obviously want to win a championship every year, but 44 wins, second round, you know, looking like a team, you know, poised to keep moving forward, would you be surprised that you're here right now?
You know, I would probably say yes, but the one thing I said most of the year last year is I didn't want to put a ceiling, I didn't want to put expectations, as I wanted to. The emphasis last year, and from almost every year, is about the process of starting a season and getting better individually and collectively, and see what you can accomplish. And even when we were in Seattle, we never put a goal of number of wins. Obviously, the goal was to win the division and go to the NBA Finals. But you know, to say, I wouldn't say 13 months ago, but you know, after July 1st and LaMarcus had made his decision to leave and go to San Antonio, obviously things had changed, but I don't think any of us, you know, I think Damian Lillard in particular said, we're not going to be as bad as people think we're going to be. We got a lot of guys who can have a lot of energy, a lot of heart, and we'll see what we can do. But I don't know. It certainly, things worked out probably better than I could have hoped for.
There were a lot of guys that were underestimated on your team. None, though, more than CJ McCollum coming into the year. And I almost, in sort of my making predictions kind of way, I kick myself for not seeing what CJ was in that Memphis series prior to the end of your season a year before. You know, he looked like a guy that was poised to take the next step. Did you see this kind of ascension for CJ coming this year?
I knew he was going to have a good year, and I knew he would probably be in the conversation for most improved. That now, I wouldn't have said, you know, how many points he was going to average or anything else, but I knew that the opportunity was going to be there, and he was going to take full advantage of it because he's extremely skilled. He can put the ball in the basket. And, you know, there were some question marks about him. One was his health, because he had injuries each of the three previous seasons. We made him our backup point guard, and that was something that he hadn't done at this level. So there were certainly question marks about in certain areas. But the fact that he could score and do what he can do well, I don't think that surprised anybody within our organization.
And Damian Lillard, it just seems like, you mentioned at the top of the podcast that, you know, you guys are aware of, you don't need to put bulletin board material up there. Guys are generally aware of what people are saying about him. Lillard seems like he's aware of like everything, like every little criticism that's out there, whether it's, you know, the USA basketball stuff, all-star stuff, anything people are saying about him. It seems like he's aware, and it almost resonates from him, at least from watching on TV and the handful of times I got to see you guys in person. Is that anywhere close to accurate?
Well, I will say, in this day and age, I think everybody knows what everybody's saying about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they don't read it, a friend reads it, or a friend retweets it, or forwards the tweet to, you know, so it's really hard not to know what is going on out there. And people can try and say, no, I don't pay any attention to that. But I think Damian's a very honest person, and he's true to himself. And, you know, to say that he doesn't know what is being said, or it would be it wouldn't be truthful. So, and I think a lot of players and a lot of people in general use that as motivation. I find it funny how people think that Damian is alone in that, with that, because mm-hmm. I think you know, you have goals and you want to, he wants to do well and he wants to prove what he can do. And so I think it's more about what he is capable of rather than what people are saying.
Do you have like you personally have like a sneaky Twitter account that you just kind of follow your guys and?
Oh yeah. Yeah. As Damian said, I'm a twatcher.
That's a terrible word, but okay.
Anyway, I was at a coach's clinic 3 or 4 years ago, and you know, we're talking about Twitter and social media, and I think it would be a disservice as a coach if you were not following your players and knowing what was going on in their lives and what's important to them, and you know, whether, no matter what it is, good and bad, family, trips, I think it's a lot of information, and you should know what your players are saying and talking about.
Does how you have to talk to players, Terry, is it different now than in your first head coaching run? Because people, there's a perception out there that players are more sensitive nowadays. You can't be that hard-nosed coach kind of anymore in today's NBA. Is it different now than what it was 15 years ago?
I think that's hard for me to say because – I've always viewed it kind of the same way. You know, I'm kind of the person that I am. Certainly, I've always felt like in the NBA and professional basketball, you treat your guys as men, and you know, you're not. It's not a college atmosphere. They've gone through college. They're young men, and sometimes older men. And I think you need to treat them as such. And the other part is, I think you coach to your personality. And if your personality is such that, I think that. That is how you communicate with your players, is through your personality. And the one thing I will say is that I think that players respect when coaches are being themselves, because they can read through people and they can tell when it's disingenuous, and that's the best way to go.
You mentioned that your guys, especially a guy like Damian, said, you know, we're not going to be as bad as people are projecting here. Was there a point early in the season where you kind of looked at this team and like, okay, you know, they think they're going to be good, and in fact, it might actually turn out to be true.
Yeah, there were, you know, it's easy to look back on the season, but I think the first thing was opening night. We came out and we beat the New Orleans at home, and we were up 20, and New Orleans was a team that was everybody had picked to make the playoffs. So we won that game relatively easily, and we said at that point, I said, you know, we're going to be able to compete. I don't know what level, you know, we're going to be, but here's a team that's picked to make the playoffs, and we can compete with these teams. And you know, I think that was a big game for us. Obviously, there were games along the way that we lost some close games that against some good teams that we say, you know, we're in these games. And what we turned around in the second half of the season was we started winning some of those close games that we kicked in the first half of the season.
I'll finish up here, Terry. When you look back at your coaching career, was there a piece of advice, you know, something that you were taught along the way that's, you know, kind of resonated with you and has been kind of one of your principles throughout?
Yeah. You know, I'm sure you know Tim Gergerich.
Sure.
He's a coach.
He loves the media. Loves the media.
Oh, loves the media.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know if you know who he is. You probably haven't spoken with him. But you know, he is a great coach, and a lot of fans may not even know who he is. But he is so well respected in the coaching profession. And I had the good fortune of being with him in Seattle and also in Dallas. But the advice he gave me was, you know, just keep coaching. You got to keep coaching them. And, you know, it's a simple statement, but it means you come to work every day and you come with enthusiasm and you come, the players can feel your energy every day. And win or lose, you got to keep coaching them. If there's a situation where somebody's pissed off, you got to keep coaching them. And there's going to be bumps along the road, and you got to keep coaching them. And to me, that's, I always come back to that. You lose three or four in a row, you got to keep coaching them. And I think it's a simple statement, but it also, I think it just, it prioritizes everything for you. And it doesn't matter if you're a head coach or an assistant coach, you got to keep coaching them.
Tim Gergerich is like a basketball Game of Thrones character. Like he just sort of lurks behind the scenes.
I'm staying away from that one.
No, but I say that as a positive. Like he just kind of lurks behind the scenes, and he's like this voice in the heads of so many coaches out there.
Well, he is, and you know the coaches who have been fortunate enough to work with him, and you know he has touched a lot of lives in the basketball world, players and coaches, and. He, and at the collegiate level and the NBA level, I think he's been single-handedly one of the most influential coaches in the NBA over the last 25 years, and he certainly has the respect of every coach in the league.
Can we push for, like, dental night in Portland next year? Like, everyone wears white coats with Stotts, DDS?
I'd rather do a 70s night so I can pull out a leisure suit. I think that would be more fun.
You don't aspire to like just to have your name Stotts DDS on a white coat someday, just to have?
No, those days are long gone.
Well, Terry, congratulations. It's been a fantastic year for you guys and tremendous success for you personally. Best of luck, and I really appreciate the time here on the podcast.
Chris, thanks for having me on your show. I always enjoy reading what you have online.
Thanks, Terry. I appreciate you.
All right, take care.
Take care. Thanks for listening, and thanks to my guests, Adrian Wojnarowski from The Vertical and Terry Stotts from the Portland Trailblazers. Remember, you can download this podcast and all archive podcasts anywhere you can download podcasts. That's iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, you name it. Also, don't forget to get The Vertical Podcast with J.J. Redick and The Vertical Podcast with Woj. I'll catch you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.